in the Great Depression, emissions fell by some 35% between 1929 and 1932, and he's predicting an even greater fall with the recession or depression, as he sees it, that we're going into. And he was quoted at the end of last year as saying that he thinks that the downturn is much more severe than economists realise, and we may see a 40 to 50% CO2 emissions fall globally between now and 2012. Now, if we do see a 40 or 50% emissions cut globally, then that is more than anyone been conceivably hoping for from a climate change perspective. And we will need to move very fast to both support the humanitarian impacts of that economic freefall, but then also to lock in the carbon savings that come with it.
Welcome to the 300 to 350 show, a syndicated radio programme that campaigns for a safe climate. And on today's show, we're going to be looking at some of the ways that the climate crunch and the credit crisis are interreacting. But we're going to go straight to an important race now. We can bring you live from the grassy knoll at the Global Meltdown Derby.
Time for the jockeys' nerves to set in. They're on their starters' orders. Tsunami waves of fear engulf the market and they're off. Wave of panic hits, further fragilities predicted, crisis strikes sandy shore, making a pretty good start. Sublime mortgage looking shaky as they come around the first bend. Downright greed from harbinger of war. 5 years down the long, torturous, blood-soaked road, loading and fair in Wall Street, following short selling, ninja loans, derivatives, stifling, suffocating sorrow and inner sanctum running well. High rollers rolling in the bankers' gambling bonanza and his worldwide famine running good on the inside. James Stain and Bear Stearns looking beleaguered. Economic breakdown. Hedge funds defaulters at Beaches Brook, also a faller to FTSE. Worst falls is 9/11. Recession fears spark global share collapse, charging down the field. Blue Mondays followed by Black Wednesdays on from Black Fridays, wiping $77 billion off cities' blue stocks come to the next fence. With boxer Joe Lewis blowing $1 billion on the day, credit crunching gowls haunting global market, betting shares collapsing into obscure corners, financial zombies are surfacing. Another takeover, a lot of turbulence and indiscriminate movement in the middle of the field. Head honchos of Merrill Lynch, Citigroup, Swiss UBS are well out of the race to complete global meltdown. The market is needing more money. Federal Reserve rescue battle for resolution as the Trump Canal turn. Wild durations in Wall Street and Singapore Joe. Singapore Joe injects $5 billion into Merrill. China makes flexes growing financial muscle. Snaps up 12% of Rio Tinto and Dawn raid. Sisyphus the leader. Sisyphus the pushes Northern Rock uphill for eternity. Olympic torch being pushed out of the race. Billions borrowed. Downright greed charging up the hill from excess corporate tax exemptions and a lot of money buried in tax havens. The drama surrounding big bank bailout unfolding. Debt rising. Greedy speculators spreading scandalously false rumours. Pirate Captain JP Morgan to the rescue train by user of Blair, warmongering peace envoy for the Middle East. Further back, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac and AIG. Toxic assets followed by economic slowdown on from consumer credit with price of commodities, oil, rice, copper and wheat went to an all-time high. Had dramatic effect as we face a deceleration. On from emergency stop, had been travelling at too formidable a pace. Now it's shell-shocked. ExxonMobil announced record profits riding roughshod. H-Bus banks trying to claw their way back from the brink. Back from the brink on from global warming. Global warming running a fast race. Gaia can't take much more. Amazonian forests and other fallers that come to the open ditch. Kevin King pumping more into the financial system, ensuring banks can't be brought down by heavy going. Right there in the centre is liquidity crisis, heading for the chair. Frank Lloyd fairing new discrepancy to system. Rogue traders had been jumping well in the middle of the field. Car industry's big tree on the road to ruin. Global warming with sublime. Tens of thousands of homes to be repossessed. Unemployment rising rapidly. Recession followed by depression, pushed hard by Bush Boy. Apocalyptic rider with two left to jump. It's Bush Boy to follow with Barack Obama looking strong, promising more troops to Afghanistan. Now a select committee taking up the running, putting the pressure on dynamic disgrace. Gracias to whistleblower overtakes fastest chief. Dodgy dealing and using too much whip on from Airbus. Flashless Gordon Sertetti looking stunned on the rails. Gracias to Amron, another Russian oligarch. Defaulting. Gangrene dinosaurs of world banking gout ridden on their knees with all round profound apologies and more backslapping and backstabbing. still demanding big, mega big bonuses as economy is careening to disaster. Politicians blowing thousands on expenses, still sitting on many corporate boards as we come to the final fence. Taxpayer left holding banksters' illegitimate baby as peripheral countries face famine after years of debt servicing and debt peonage. Harbinger for Jimmy Well is still global warming ahead of worldwide famine on the home straight. Worldwide famine overtaken by downright greed with two farms from home. Global warming is thundering strong on the inside from downright greed and as to come across the line is global warming ahead of downright greed followed by worldwide famine. Then comes Harbinger of War with great shares from the crowd for The Outsider. Global warming.
Okay, you've been listening to the Global Meltdown Derby performed by Grassy Knoll, an Irish poet living in London who we hope to catch up with at the end of the programme when he's managed to catch his breath back. I invited Knoll in because I think it's a clever evocation of the converging crisis we now face, and it echoes something that Lord Nicholas Stern said recently in a talk to launch his new book. A member of the audience asked him if there was a danger that politicians would be distracted from the problem of climate change by the economic situation. Only if they have small minds, was his reply. We're going to be looking at the relationship, as I say, between the economic downturn and climate change, and asking whether the former might be our best hope of solving the latter. And this is one of the questions I put to Tim Helveg Larsen, director of the Public Interest Research Centre think tank, who was a co-author of the important Zero Carbon Britain and Climate Safety Reports. Before we hear that interview, though, Kevin Anderson, research director of the Tyndall Centre, the UK's leading climate change policy research institution, speaking at the launch of the Climate Safety Report back in November 2008 and reinforcing the message from last week's programme about the need to move international and national climate policy away from long-term targets to emissions budgets and emissions trajectories.
Now, targets, traditionally, I think probably many of you have heard about this recently, we've talked about long-term targets, 80% reduction by 2050 or 60% reduction by 2050. It's all about 2050 or 2100. It's not about now. Out of our term of office, I think is one of the terms some people use. CO2 stays in the atmosphere for well over 100 years, well in excess of that now. So in fact, that's not really the appropriate way to look at the problem. You really have to say that these final percentage reductions have almost nothing to do with climate change. What matters are the cumulative emissions, as the emissions build up day in, day out, year in, year out. This fundamentally rewrites the whole chronology of climate change. It moves us away from these long-term gradual reductions that we traditionally are used to, towards urgent and radical reductions. This is Mr. Stern again. Annual reductions of greater than 1% per annum only ever been associated with economic recession or upheaval. We're getting a bit more used to this now anyway. But that was only 1%. Now let's look at the best example we actually have of doing something. The UK dash for gas, big reduction from emissions because we swapped from coal to gas, or the French 40-fold increase in nuclear power over about 20 years. These are the best examples that we've got of moving into a low-carbon supply route. It wasn't for those reasons, but that's what we did. They were only linked with about a 1% per annum reduction, and that excluded aviation and shipping. So basically, the best example we have historically had no reduction in emissions. But there is an example out there which you can rely on. The collapse of the Soviet Union gave us 5% reduction in emissions per annum for about 10 years. A reality check on this. If economic growth is not possible with 6% per annum reductions in emissions, and I think most of us would probably say that's a little unlikely, then we have no option, it would appear to me, I would look forward to hearing any other options than this, than having a planned economic recession.
Kevin Anderson, he's basically arrived at the conclusion that what we need is a planned economic contraction on an unprecedented scale, perhaps a kind of faster wind down of economic activity than they saw in Russia during the 1990s. We could say in climate terms that it's been lucky for us that we have had such a downturn over the last year or so. Does it look likely that emissions are coming down as a result of that?
It does look like they are coming down. I haven't seen the very latest figures, but a couple of months ago it was looking like the UK's emissions had dropped by 2% against the same time in the previous year. And it's a tricky one to manage and understand because it basically complicates the climate change message. Here we are in a situation where we can see fossil fuel use has been growing exponentially, and the message must clearly be that we have to stop that. And then if emissions cuts come from an unexpected quarter, namely economic recession or depression, how do we deal with that? And surely we should be grateful for those cuts, but they also come with pain, obviously. And there's a climate change concern as well that we need to make absolute absolutely sure that these cuts, wherever they come from, are locked in. So when Kevin Anderson talks about a planned economic recession, that's absolutely the last thing anyone in the world of politics or business wants to hear. But there's more than a grain of truth in what he's saying, that we really do need very large short-term cuts. I saw in figures that came out just yesterday were showing that Germany over the last year has its GDP has dropped by over 6%. And I think, if I remember Kevin Anderson's figures correctly, Russia was collapsing at 5% a year. So Germany is already experiencing that in the last year, and this last quarter seems to be even more harsh. I think what this all stems from is really that we've been finding it much easier to borrow money than to save money. And when you have this ready access to money and the purchasing power that it brings, it means you can buy an awful lot more fossil fuel and an awful lot more capacity to burn it than you would have if you were busy saving. So when we hear about credit crunch, it's really saying that there's a, if not an end, a pause or a stop in that process of accessing money beyond our means, and therefore accessing carbon and fossil fuels beyond our means. The idea of emissions reductions coming from unexpected quarters isn't completely off the wall. Terry Barker is the director of the Cambridge Centre for Climate Change Mitigation Research, and he was saying that in the Great Depression, emissions fell by some 35% between 1929 and 1932, and he's predicting an even greater fall with the recession or depression, as he sees it, that we're going into. And he was quoted at the end of last year as saying that he thinks that the downturn is much more severe than economists realise, and we may see a 40 to 50% CO2 emissions fall globally between now and 2012. Now, if we do see a 40 or 50% emissions cut globally, then that is more than anyone been conceivably hoping for from a climate change perspective, and we will need to move very fast to both support the humanitarian impacts of that economic, well, freefall, but then also to lock in the carbon savings that come with it. I think it's going to take a very careful look to see who is suffering and where the pain is. We clearly don't need to worry too much about screams from bankers, but there are going to be real people all over the world who are affected by an economic collapse of that order. And I don't really know if that's what the probability or likelihood of that happening is, but I wouldn't discount it entirely. I think when we talk about sustainability or unsustainability, we're talking about a period within now or the next 12, 24, 36 months probably, where we find that you cannot sustainably travel up an exponential curve. At some point it collapses, and that's the case as much for our money system as it might be for our access to fossil fuels.
I mean, also, if it wasn't for the climate situation, which has a greater urgency, I think it's clear now, we'd also be seeing some economic contraction ahead through peaking oil supplies, which somebody like Colin Campbell has made clear.
Yeah.
But Ed Miliband is resisting the idea that we should start talking about a non-growth story, so a low-carbon future that isn't about economic growth, and is more about well-being. His argument is that if we say that a low-carbon future is a low-growth story or a negative growth story, then China won't sign on to an international deal. Have you got a response to that?
Well, I think what Mr. Miliband is probably experiencing is that there is a very rich and detailed and prosperous picture that's been painted of a world in growth. And the same rich and detailed picture hasn't yet, I don't think, been painted for a steady state economy, for a sustainable economy. And that's absolutely something that we should be supporting him in. Maybe it's for him to do himself, but when he says that a steady state economy is not a message that is going to be swallowed by China, we have to ask ourselves, why is it that we haven't been able to communicate the extra benefits of even the economic benefits of efficiency, the economic benefits of using renewables instead of fossil fuels, The social benefits of getting to know your neighbours more by moving more locally, being closer to the means of production for your food and your services. That picture is still fairly clunky and clumsy. I find it clunky and clumsy to talk about because it's so foreign from the world we live in today. But we need to build that picture in a very rich and detailed way if we want to draw politicians and countries towards it.
Okay. Again, going back to Kevin Anderson and Alice Bowes, we have this tiny emissions budget available to us, and we really want to get to zero carbon as soon as possible,
yep.
I think is the message of the Climate Safety Report. And you've factored in all the observational science that's coming out of the Arctic.
Yep.
So, yeah, what Kevin Anderson and Alice Bowes have been saying for some time now is that really to keep within such a tight budget, we really need to act fast and to make early cuts as soon as possible.
Absolutely.
And one of the biggest tools we've got in our kind of policy box is demand reduction.
Yep.
And they say we should refocus on demand reduction. But again, this isn't something that the government is starting to talk about or appears to have heard currently.
I think it's the same issue as steady state instead of growth. Demand reduction is absolutely talking about moving on to a steady state footing, and it's not as politically attractive as the fashionable story of growth. There are all sorts of technical reasons and social reasons why a steady state economy would be a better economy and a more wholesome and fulfilling economy than a growth one, and why demand reduction is absolutely needed. What we've got to do, it's incumbent on all of us, is to find the ways to communicate that. I think the key point is from Kevin and Alice is unavoidable. We have to be making these cuts, and we have to be making them now. And what we saw very clearly as we got to the end of writing the Climate Safety Report was that really any stabilisation level for greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, whether it's 450, 550, or down at 350, or even lower, if you want any hope or any chance of reaching those, you have to be on the reductions track right now. You have to be moving hard and fast towards zero carbon right now. And so really, given the uncertainty about climate change, and yet given the very large scale of it and the great urgency that we're seeing from work looking at carbon budgets that Anderson and Bowes are doing, it's clear that we have to just get on that track. And only once we're on that track, racing out of carbon, will we have the luxury to fine-tune our trajectory and see if or what stabilisation level we need to stabilise at.
George Monbiot was saying we could reduce carbon emissions by 25% by 2012, which is very soon and very,
yeah,
very quick. I'm not sure if anyone's looked at his suggestions and whether they stack up or not.
Yeah.
But if the UK government kind of took this approach, there'd be certain an advantage in us leading from the front in that way, yeah?
Yeah, it's absolutely a reason and a need to, as you say, lead from the front. I think the way I would look at it or frame it is that the negotiations that we've had internationally, these UN climate negotiations, have embodied a culture of apportioning blame, really, or apportioning, they talk about burden sharing. It's like there's this much burden. Obviously, we're trying to avoid the burden of climate change, but we have to take on the burden of economic hardship. So let's split it like this, and you take all of that economic hardship, and I'll just take this little bit of economic hardship. So it's all sort of pushing around hardship and burden, responsibility, and really, if we as a nation can, if Britain or any country, in fact, can actually start demonstrating that they are making real cuts in greenhouse gas emissions now, and that they're doing it because it's the right thing to do, and they're doing it because it saves them money. They're saving money because they are more efficient in the way they use energy, and they're saving money because the energy that they do use is coming from renewable sources, which means that they don't have to pay for fossil fuels. So if Britain can go into those international negotiations and say, this is the cut that we are making now. We're making a cut now because we have to be on this track out of carbon, and we're making this cut now because it's right for an awful lot of reasons. And how can we learn from the rest of the world about the approaches that they're taking, and how can we help the rest of the world? That would be such a completely different approach. It would, I think, change the game if countries could go in with that positive attitude of this is what we're doing. Because a nation faces the same problem that any individual faces with climate change, which is that for the climate change to be solved, or for us even to begin solving climate change, we have to take action ourselves, and we have to trust that everyone else is going to take action. And it's a very difficult thing to do because we aren't in control of everybody else. And all we can do is to take action ourselves and show the world, show other people that we're doing it and that it's the right thing to do, and hope and trust that they will do so too.
Okay. Going back to demand reduction, the Zero Carbon Britain report was basically a mixture of power down and power up.
Yep.
So in terms of power down, that's demand reduction, just using less,
yeah,
reducing our energy demand overall by 50% was the scenario.
Yeah.
And that was achieved through carbon rationing. Is that still your preferred method or approach to demand management?
I think it is. There's,
or a version of that, because there's domestic tradable quotas and tradable energy quotas as well.
Yeah, well, one has changed name into the other now. I think that there are a number of advantages through doing it with a scheme like tradable energy quotas. It means that you start off with a very clear cap that is designed to match the amount of carbon that's been scientifically decided we can burn, and then it provides a first approximation, a very good approximation, I would hope, at sharing that carbon out equitably. And what it crucially does, which might otherwise be missed, is that it engages everybody in the country in an awareness of this carbon problem and of getting off this carbon problem. So if any individual person is going to buy petrol or gas or a sack of coal even, they have to hand over these carbon permits. And so it makes those fossil fuel, those carbon transactions, feel very real to people. And it provides a way of, if you like, uniting all the people and businesses in the country with the government to tackle this problem and get really creative and innovative about finding ways of avoiding using these fossil fuels.
Do you have any other big picture stuff that you'd like to throw in about what the science is really telling us now in terms of how we need to move forward?
Well, in terms of big picture, you've quite rightly pointed to the need for demand reduction as the first port of call, and it absolutely is. I'm guilty as the next person that I find it easier to sell the idea of renewable energy than I do of making savings. And so with that caveat in place, I'll just tell you what's exciting me at the moment, which is that Britain has an absolutely vast energy potential offshore, both in terms of our offshore wind resource, but also the untapped wave and tidal potential. The point I always make about marine technologies, wave and tidal, is that moving water being 1,000 times denser than air, moving water is carrying 1,000 times the energy of air that moves at the same speed. Now, it doesn't always move at the same speed, and there are different places where you'll be able to tap it than you can tap wind. But that's a technology that we've only just begun to get a sniff at, and it's not surprising that the marine technologies that have been shown to succeed or have been most promising were not the ones that were designed to be most efficient. They were the ones that were designed to survive. And the technology has moved on a little bit further now, so that it's now not just the technologies that were able to survive those incredibly powerful conditions, but it's the ones that are cost-effective to maintain, so where you can lift them out of the water, for instance, very easily and change the bearings or re-grease this or that. So I'm very keen to understand the full economic value of our offshore renewable resource. And the reason that I say the economic value is that I suspect that the economic value of our renewables will get far more traction within Whitehall than will an understanding of the energy potential or of the carbon mitigation potential of that energy. And I think when we look into it, which it's only a matter of time before these numbers start surfacing, what we'll see is that it's going to be worth hundreds of billions of pounds. We've got the single largest offshore wind resource of any country in Europe, and it's significantly larger than our domestic demand for energy. And what we need to recognise is that actually that offshore potential is an export commodity for Britain. It's something that we could be exporting into Europe as zero carbon electricity, and it can also be saving us money through avoided fossil fuel imports for our own energy use. And in doing that, we're going to build an absolutely world-class expertise in these technologies, which is yet another sort of economic boost. So I'm very keen to see numbers put to this and to see a full economic valuation of our vast offshore energy gold mine, really.
That was Tim Helveg Larsen, Director of the Public Interest Research Centre think tank and co-author of the Zero Carbon Britain and Climate Safety Reports, with some useful insights, I think, there. And in other news, on May the 26th, the trial of Ken Saro-Wiwa versus Shell finally gets underway in New York, over 13 years after Saro-Wiwa was hung, with, I think, eight of his fellow campaigners. And one of the things they were campaigning against was gas flaring, amongst other things. And Shell's gas flaring continues in the Niger Delta. And there's a renewed campaign in the light of the trial to bring that finally to an end. It's, of course, a terrible waste of carbon emissions and natural gas, and it does environmental damage to the local community there. And we still have Grassy Knoll in the studio with us, who has been involved with a similar, or seen how Shell works firsthand in the battle that they're having. I think it's been going on for 9 years in County Mayo. Perhaps you could bring us up to speed on what's happening there and what that campaign is all about.
Well, the campaign, as you rightly say, been going on 9 years. Shell have been trying to build a massive big refinery in Mayo. The land was more or less given to them by the Irish government for a very, very minimal fee. It was land that was originally forestry land. It's in a beautiful estuary. It's an environmentally protected area. And at this moment in time, they're trying to make the final link up to the pipeline. On last year, there was a big problem because Shell were unable to link up because Moira Harrington, one of the local teachers, a retired teacher now, went in hunger strike and disabled Shell by proceeding with the works at that moment in time, because they thought internationally it would be a fiasco with the negative publicity had she died in this particular moment. And at the moment, there's a lot of fishermen still involved in the campaign, a lot of the local farmers. Indeed, Willie Carduff was nearly beaten very, very badly by the security, 15 of security, dressed in black with black balaclavas, and the second anniversary of him winning an international environmental award.
Right, so the struggle goes on. And I understand that there's been a link, a kind of solidarity between the campaigns in Nigeria and County Mayo as well.
Well, at this moment in time, I'd like to say there's been a lot of international solidarity, and Ken Saro-Wiwa's brother has come over, his nephew, as far as I'm aware, has been over there. A lot of other support has come in from Nigeria. A lot of support has come from England over the years as well. It's one of the things that people overlook, that the English have actually, a lot of people have gone over to the camp, and a lot of people have actually supported it. A lot of people throughout the world have come to Ireland to actually support this particular fight, because it is a very, very small amount of farmers that are putting up a very, very good fight against a transnational corporation. One of the wealthiest last year to announce their profit. I think it's the biggest corporate profit that any company in Britain has ever made.
And there's a week of international action against Shell's various abuses starting. I think maybe it's already started. There was the Shell AGM on Tuesday, and there were fire eaters outside of that, amongst other things. And the place to get the update on the trial, which should be bring out some amazing information, I think, if you go to www.shellguilty.com, I think you can follow the trial as it kind of unfolds over the next few weeks or perhaps even months. And there must be a web link for the County Mayo campaign as well.
Yes, shellguilty.com, and there's a big meeting out there. A lot of people are coming from England, from around the world, for 1st of June. There's going to be a lot of major protests. And this week, the government is actually questioning whether or not they have the rights to compulsory purchase this land, because at this moment they don't own the land.
Right, OK, so Shell's still got a few battles to fight if it wants to get its own way up there.
I think for the sake of the environment and the whole west coast of Ireland, there's a lot of oil, a lot of gas out there. I mean, once the gas is in, presumably the oil will follow, and it'll have detrimental effects to the whole west coast of Ireland.
OK, we've run out of time. Thanks again very much for coming in and
it's been a pleasure
performing earlier for us. And just to say, references for this week's programme and to listen again, go to climateradio.org. And thanks for listening.